Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we're at the historic Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown to listen in on a conversation between authors Michael Cunningham and Daniel Mendelsohn, presented by 20 Summers. Michael Cunningham is the author of the novels A Home at the End of the World, Flesh and Blood, and The Hours, winner of the Pulitzer Prize. Daniel Mendelsohn is an internationally best-selling author, critic, essayist, and translator. His books include An Odyssey, A Father, A Son, and An Epic, and The Lost, The Search for 6 of 6 Million.
Michael and I were talking a little bit before this started about how we were going to proceed when Camille first approached us about doing something together. We both sort of decided instantly all through an email chain that we did not want a moderator, that we would moderate each other. And so we just wanted to really have a conversation. And in fact, it's almost embarrassing to be introduced in such lofty terms, since what we're actually just discussing in the green room was the fine points of cruising in the 1990s.
Thank you for sharing that.
And how it's an art lost to the younger generation.
Yeah. You know, we
who only desire their cell phones. So, but we will now be very high-minded and literary.
Oh, I don't know about that.
But we had to, so I told Michael that I wanted to be up first, largely for sentimental reasons. When I first started writing in the very late 1980s and early 90s, always for tiny gay magazines that folded a week before they were supposed to pay you. The first book I ever reviewed at the beginning of what became my career as a literary critic was A Home at the End of the World. And so it's really great 497 years later to be able to sit up here and talk to Michael. When Camille approached us and you know, we thought, what would we be talking about? And it just seemed like such a natural, since in our very different ways, Michael as a novelist and me as a, I guess, narrative nonfiction person, to sort of talk about the way that we take other works of literature and turn it into our own texts. And a thing I thought about, I was rereading a piece I wrote about the movie of The Hours, which I wrote for the New York Review of Books when that movie came out. And if you read it, you can tell that I really just wanted to write about the book, which I hadn't had an opportunity to do. And I guess the thing that very much struck me, and then I reread the book, is what does it mean when you're working as a novelist? So you're thinking about a novel or a writer, Virginia Woolf, Walt Whitman in Specimen Days. I think the temptation is, when you're doing this kind of thing where you want to sort of invoke or allude to or pay homage to a work that you love or a writer that you love, you know, the temptation is to sort of allude, right, to show that you know the work in some way, you know, because you love it and it's sort of coming out of your pores. But I think in The Hours, what you do is something sort of more profound, which is to sort of do what Virginia Woolf wanted to do, which is to write a novel about women that makes women's lives meaningful in terms of their own, rather than just recreating men's way of thinking about women. So I wanted to this is just something I've always wanted to ask, you know, how did it come to you? At what point did you know how you were going to do it? I guess that's the question.
Sure. Just very quickly, The Hours is three interwoven stories, one of which is a kind of contemporary version of Woolf's great character, Clarissa Dalloway. The other is the day, the sort of imagined day in the life of Virginia Woolf when she started writing Mrs. Dalloway. And the third is a homemaker in the 50s who is reading Mrs. Dalloway. I started out to simply write a contemporary version. It was actually going to be a gay. It was going to be a gay Mrs. Dalloway.
No.
It didn't seem like a bad idea at the time. I know. Well, you know, I was living. I'm going to try to keep this on the short side. I was living in Chelsea, and you know, Mrs. Dalloway takes place in London society in the 20s, where Mrs. Dalloway is giving a party, and there's who to invite. There's a whole sense of who matters more, who matters less. And I thought, I know that world. I live in that world. Hmm. It stretches between 14th Street and 23rd Street. Its inhabitants are men, but that's exactly that. Hmm. It's about youth and beauty and money, and I thought, I'm going to set Mrs. Dalloway in gay New York right now. And, you know, it didn't take me that long to realize, well, that's a stupid idea.
But why?
Well, it felt like a conceit. Uh-huh. And not like a book. You want to write a book that feels somehow necessary, a book you think is missing in the world. And I just felt like that's a stunt.
And we already have the boys in the band.
And we already have the boys in the band. Yeah. If we needed the dose of homosexual self-loathing, there's always that to go to. Oh, God, forget I said that. Edit that out.
So when did you decide it wasn't
working as it's just sort of rethinking of Mrs. Dalloway. There's already a Mrs. Dalloway. We don't really need my take on it. I thought about... I tried to bring Virginia Woolf into it, and it still wasn't working. It still felt like an idea for a book rather than an actual book that had some place in the world, that had some kind of urgent life of its own. And I was about to just give it up. Well, you know, some ideas just don't pan out. Mm-hmm. And this is not taking on the kind of life a book needs to have. And the year's work, you don't just throw it out overnight. And I was sitting there in my studio thinking about Virginia Woolf and Mrs. Dalloway, and I suddenly had this image of my mother. And I thought, you know, Mom, what are you doing in my hallucination? And as I thought about it, I thought about how my mother was a homemaker and a wife, and it was a life that was too small for her. I don't think it's a life that's categorically too small for anybody, but it wasn't right for her. Mm-hmm. But she couldn't break out of it, and so she was obsessive about everything. Those cocktail napkins she'd spent all day buying turned out to be wrong, and she had to take them back the next day, and she really would bake a cake and throw it out and start another cake. And I always thought of her as a sort of Amazon queen, captured and made to live in an enclosure in which she couldn't move. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, okay, take Virginia Woolf and take my mother, remove the end product. One of them is working on what will prove to be a great work of literature. The other is trying to bake a cake so perfect that it banishes sorrow. The book technically matters more than the cake. Though a cake matters. I mean, no disrespect to cakes. But I thought, if you take that away and just look at these two women's individual desires to transcend what they can do, to do more than they're technically capable of doing, my mother gets to be in the book just as surely as Virginia Woolf does. Mm-hmm. And there she was. And then suddenly it was these three parts, and it felt like it could go.
Well, then it did go. I mean, to me, so this is what I mean, because what to me is so interesting and moving about the book is, so you're just now saying, well, you know, a cake is in a book. But that to me sums up why this book so successfully makes literature out of literature, right? Which is that Virginia Woolf herself, so this is what I mean when I say it's the difference between, there's a whole section about Virginia Woolf, and she's writing, she's deciding to write Mrs. Dalloway, and you've obviously done a tremendous amount of homework, and there are sentences in there which are sentences from her journals and, you know, all of that. But the spirit of the book, what makes it, I think, more profound and interesting is the spirit of the book is Woolfian, because Virginia Woolf actually wrote, women's lives are always being judged by the criteria of men. If it's about a battle, if it's about a war, I mean, this is something she wrote, I'm just paraphrasing, yeah, right? But yeah, she said, but if, you know, if it's a prime minister or if it's, you know, as I say, a battle or something, then it's important. But if it's choosing scarves or looking at perfumes or cooking dinner, it's automatically not important. I mean, there's, I had dug up some quote of her saying something just like this when I was working on this piece. So the cake is equal to the book for her. She's the one who said it. She's the one who said, we need a literature about women that, I mean, she's writing in 1925, but, you know, that takes the stuff of women's lives, or as she thought of it then, and makes it important. That doesn't say a cake is not as important, because for her, it was as important. And Laura baking the cake is equal to Virginia writing her book. And that's what the book dignifies her life, and it's... Right. That's what I think is so exciting about it, that the book is not just about Virginia Woolf and about Mrs. Dalloway and reincarnating the character in a modern... It does something that is Woolfian. That, to me, was what was so moving about it.
Yeah, and it's sometimes you need a cake more than you need a book.
Well, and who's
depending
to
on
say,
the circumstances.
Right? Who's to say? Yeah. And her complaint was that the people who do say what's more important are usually men.
Yeah. When the hours came out, I used to get in fights with people about who would say, well, of course, Virginia Woolf was wonderful, but she was no James Joyce. So, well, no, actually, she was a woman. What you're saying is she's secondary because she wrote about women's lives.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, no disrespect to James Joyce, but you know what? I mean, there was this kind of assumption that she was of secondary stature, and I thought, nuh-uh, not to me.
But it's, you know, it's still, as we know, it's still pervasive in many ways. Anyway, I thought that was, to me, what was the most Woolfian thing in the book, was not that Virginia Woolf was a character, but you were doing something that Virginia Woolf was interested in doing.
Well, this is the last time the word cake, I think, has to be spoken on this afternoon. But I realized that when I was sort of trying to find my way into the book, I had to accommodate the notion that the cake in the book, that I had to get over my own sense that the book matters in ways that the cake doesn't.
Right. That's hard.
It was hard
it
for me.
Hard.
It took it. Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to always ask about this is, you know, I thought it occurred to me, you know, after I talked to Camille, that another person who could be in this conversation, well, many people could, mm-hmm. is Colm Tóibín, who wrote a wonderful book about Henry James, actually wrote a novel about Henry James called The Master, which is, again, a bold move. And it leads me to a thought about what you did in The Hours, although at a certain point in the conversation, maybe after we talk about my father, we'll come back to Specimen Days, which is another book in which you do this. But to ventriloquize a great writer is a dangerous undertaking.
Yeah.
So what I would love to know, just sort of what was in your head and how you decided. I mean, there's a 1/3 of this book is really what Virginia Woolf is thinking when she's getting ready to write a great masterpiece. And that, I guess, because I'm not a novelist, you know, I just couldn't even imagine, you know, trying to get there. So how does that work?
Well, you're right. The danger is ventriloquism, which is not only uninteresting, but kind of doomed to failure. I can't write in Virginia Woolf's voice. And yet I wondered, what I did was read Virginia Woolf, Virginia Woolf, Virginia Woolf. There's a lot to read. And I just immersed myself in her, and then I closed all the books and didn't let myself open one and started writing, so that I was, to the best of my ability, sort of suffused with her voice without having... I no longer allowed myself access to her to her voice. Mm-hmm. So it was almost like,
but like a
sort of sense memory. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It completely changed my relationship to the semicolon and the parenthetical. I want to talk about an odyssey.
I will in a second. But it's very interesting to hear you say that, because I remember reading when Anthony Minghella, the film director, was adapting The English Patient into a movie, and he said exactly the same thing. He said he read the... because in a certain way, you're doing a kind of adaptation in this book, right? In a broadly construed. And he said he read the book four times, and then he threw it away, and he never looked at it again. And then, but he just had sort of absorbed it to the point where he could then be free with it, but also sort of be permeated by it. So I'm very struck when you said that.
This is a semi-tangent. One of the things that I've learned from working with translators, who sometimes have impossible questions.
Yeah.
The Chinese, my Chinese translator, who is Joni Mitchell and what is a cookie?
In that order?
You got me there. Or even like the Finnish translator, driving onto the Mad American Night, which is, you know, even if you don't know that that's from Kerouac, as an American, you get the fantasy about you know, Bruce Springsteen. Mm-hmm. It's the idea that there is something else out there, and you could just get in a big car and give it all up and drive past the horizon line. And I just thought, yeah, I bet there's no mad Finnish night to drive out into, is there now? And that, furthermore, if you are Finnish, the idea of driving toward the horizon probably has a very different and darker connotation than this kind of great American optimism and the idea that I can always be a bartender in a Mexican restaurant someplace.
Right.
Which has led me to understand that it's, and this is where it semi fits, because we are writing books that come from books. Where translation is concerned, I've come to realize that it's all translation. The original text is already a sort of not quite right translation of the greater book you had floating in the cartoon balloon over your head. Mm-hmm. And then if a Chinese translator or a Finnish translator struggles further with it, that's just another stop along the spectrum.
That's interesting. Yeah.
In its inception, it's a sort of slightly faulty translation.
That's a great, it's a great thought. As someone who has done a translation, you know,
yeah,
it certainly speaks to me. Well,
because I
always like to say that there's no, you know, when you're a critic, you're always trying to get into the head of the writer that you're writing about and to understand what she's doing or... But when there's no kind of intimacy greater than when you're translating someone. Precisely because of what you're saying about the Finnish night versus the American night, because you have to, and I guess this brings me back to my earlier question, you have to be bold enough to try to imagine what they were thinking when they said something so you could think the same thing but say it in your own language.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of knowing... a writer, to translate a writer, it's an incredibly intimate kind of knowledge.
You're listening to The Point. We'll have more of our conversation with Michael Cunningham and Daniel Mendelsohn after a break. Welcome back to The Point. Today we're at the historic Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown for a conversation between authors Michael Cunningham and Daniel Mendelsohn.
I would love to hear something about translating a poet who's also a great poet writing in Greek.
Well, it's, you know, like my grandmother used to say, man man plans and God laughs. And I sort of got into that project by accident, almost. I had knew a guy who was a photographer who was doing a series of photographs based on, or as he thought, based on Cavafy's poems, and he wanted just new translations for wall text. And so he asked me to do a few, and that's how I got into it. But there's nothing scarier than, well, as you know from working on Wolf, right, that when you're in the presence of a really great literary mind, it's humbling, humbling in a nice way. You know, it's not like, oh, I'm nothing and they're everything, but it's just like, you think you're going to do all kinds of great things. This is, I'm sure every translator has this experience, you know, you think you're going to be so much smarter than all the other translators. And in fact, you get more and more respectful of what other people have done because you realize how incredibly difficult it is when faced with really wonderful writing to do something, to do anything with it. And what I always like to say is, you know, Cavafy, when he first started, he wasn't really that good. You know, he was, well, because partly because he was sort of hiding his gayness. And, you know, there's all these early poems addressed to beautiful Turkish ladies, and they're all just preposterous and terrible. And they're, but the point of this story is they're much easier to translate. It's much easier to translate bad writing. That was my great lesson that I learned. No, but I'm not joking. Yeah, and it tells you something because it's everything that's there is apprehensible, right? Anyway, let's talk about an odyssey.
Let's do.
Okay, you go first.
Well, I'm going. I just want everyone to know if there's anyone present who hasn't read it that it is this sort of fantastic, sort of very layered. I'll call it a memoir. It's a work of autobiographical non. It's not like me where I just make all this stuff up. It essentially centers on a semester in which Daniel is teaching the Odyssey at Bard, where he does, in fact, teach. And his father, who knows the classics and has taught in his own day, sits in on the class. And you know, does he obey Daniel's injunction to sit quietly and make no comments? I'm going to let you guess. So on one hand, there is the kind of journey of going through the class with the students and Daniel's father, and the students feel very differently about it. It's fantastic, and a sort of odyssey. In a seminar room at Bard, and then it's sort of interspersed with a cruise that Daniel and his father take after the class, which is it's an Odyssey cruise. I love it that this exists.
The footsteps of Odysseus. That was the name of the cruise. Yeah.
So there is that as well. There is this layered odysseys, both involving journeys and fathers and sons and recognizability across generations, and it's remarkable and moving and beautiful. And one of my favorite lines, which is something that I'm going to have to paraphrase, I'm afraid, but on the cruise, Daniel's father said repeatedly as he was seeing the actual sites from the Odyssey, the S-I-T-E, he said, you know, the poem is more real. Which felt like a fantastic thing to say about poetry and realness. Yeah. And with that, Daniel Mendelsohn, would you just tell us anything at all about that book and what it meant to write it?
Well, you know, I have to say, there were books I thought of when I was writing this book. I mean, I've written three, I guess they're memoirs, and in each one I sort of bounce a personal story off of an ancient text to get a kind of traction or a mirroring, you know. And in my first book, which was, it's called The Elusive Embrace, which is partly about being a gay person in the 90s and becoming a parent unexpectedly. And I'm sort of using different Greek and Roman texts to sort of think about identity and sexuality and whatever. And then in my second memoir, The Lost, which is about trying to find out a family Holocaust story, I use the Hebrew Bible, sort of intersperse this story of searching to find out what happened to my relatives during the war with analyses of different texts. So, for example, I had never really thought of the story of Noah's Ark as a story about extermination and survival, but of course that's exactly what it is. But because I was in Eastern Europe looking for my murdered relatives, it suddenly hit me that this is a great text about what it means to be one of the few survivors of a great extermination. In this book, I wanted to sort of put my cards on the table from the beginning and just make it very clear that this is, you know, because of the situation which you described, it's a book about a course, about the Odyssey, which also has this zany kind of father-son story about my octogenarian father. But one of the things that happened, and one of the things I try to describe in the book, because we're talking about making literature out of literature, so what does that mean? It means you want to sort of nod to the original, let's call it, but not just nod to it, this is what I was trying to get at before, but to sort of evoke the spirit of a work. So what is the Odyssey about? It's about a guy who's good with words, Odysseus, a famous storyteller, liar, and he travels a lot, right? So I thought, you know, what is this book going to be made of? Well, it's going to be made of words and voyages. So I decided to intertwine these two events that happened to have happened during what turned out to be the last year of my dad's life, when he decided he wanted to sit in on my Odyssey seminar. So it's all talk, 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 talk. And I'm sort of recreating key classroom discussions, but all of which have, as it were, are pointed with respect to my relationship with my father, who was not the easiest of people. And then we went on this cockamamie Odyssey cruise after the course was over, and I decided to sort of weave that in. But one of the things that, you know, my father also said, so the stuff that Michael is alluding to is my father was a scientist. He was not a literature person. I mean, he was very well read, but, you know, if you're a literature person, a writer, a reader, whatever, you always love Odysseus because he's a great storyteller. He's the storyteller in the Western tradition. He gets out of difficult situations by making up fabulous stories. And my father hated him. You know, he just hated this guy, and he couldn't believe why anyone would think he was a hero, because he lied. My father, it seems so self-evident to my father that a liar is not a hero. And that became a sort of running joke. But the thing that moved me so much, which is what Michael was referring to, is so we did the semester, January to May, and then in June we get on this boat and we go to Troy. And my father, of all people, turns to me. We're standing in front of the walls of Troy, you know, the legendary walls of Troy. And he said, "Meh, the poem feels more real than the place." And I could have burst into tears. I was so gratified. I thought, that's what it means to be a literature person. I said, Nowhere I have ever gone in my life feels as real as the description of it is in a book, you know. So a lot of the book, you know, a lot of the Odyssey, as I'm sure you know, is about transformations, magical, about the ability to recognize people after long periods of time. And so I wanted to sort of work those themes into the book, and because that happened to me with my father during the course of these two experiences, the course and the cruise, that I felt like both he had been transformed and I had been transformed, you know, and our relationship had been transformed because I saw things about him that I never really understood before. And it was all because of this poem, yeah, you know, yeah, yeah. Which is much more about fathers and sons than I ever really appreciated. Because like many people, you know, you think of the Odyssey, you think, oh, it's about this guy who's trying to get back to his wife after many years. But it's actually much more about him and his son and him and his father.
Yeah, right. Your father wanted you to be a math guy.
Well, very unsuccessfully. I have an older brother who's a scientist also, but I was terrible in math, you know. But, you know, it was funny because my dad, you know, he was a tough Bronx guy.
Yeah.
But I have to say he surprised me in many ways, being who he was. You know, he's a guy born in 1929, and he went to work and he came home and he put food on the table and, you know, was not like a modern young father. You know, I don't think he ever saw a diaper in his life. I don't, you know, he didn't know how to boil a kettle of water if his life depended on it. But he was surprisingly tender in many ways, which I tried to emphasize in the book, and not least, you know, about the gay thing. When I came out to my parents, my father turned out to have quite a story that made him very sympathetic and touching, you know, when I was afraid of what his reaction would be. So one of the things I, you know, I'm just interested in about when you look to these old great works of literature, you know, it's such a cliche about what we get out of literature. But, you know, the fact is, it's a cliche worth repeating that you get things out of literature, but not necessarily in the ways that you thought. And actually, so this is a true story. My father's favorite book in the last years of his life was Your Specimen Days, which I just told Michael. My father was a great Walt Whitman fan, and he said to me on the phone in his gruff way, he said, "Have you read Cunningham's new book?" And I said, and I actually hadn't at that point, but then I did after. And he said, "This is not about Whitman. It is Whitman." And I thought, and I was so touched by that. And actually, so to come back to what you're doing, because I think, so in Specimen Days, is the aboutness, I would say, is more submerged, right?
Yes, absolutely.
That one, Whitman is sort of hovering around the edges. There are, again, three stories. They're more discreet, I think, in a certain way. And they have different genres. One is a sort of a ghost story, and the other is pure science fiction. It has robots or androids with a Whitman chip. And yet it sort of evokes Whitman without having him be present in the book the way that, say, Virginia Woolf is actually present in The Hours. But there's something really Whitman-y. I hate saying Whitman-esque for some reason.
I know. Well, anything-esque.
Because everything
could just be
is terrible. Right. There's something Whitman-y about it. And not least, I would say, in its sort of generosity. You know, it's sort of out there. It loves Whitman in all these ways and all of these genres, which, again, I think is a very Whitman attitude, so that it evokes the literature you're interested in without being about it in a kind of literal-minded way, which I think is so interesting.
You're listening to The Point. We'll have more of our conversation with Michael Cunningham and Daniel Mendelsohn right after this short break. Welcome back to The Point. Today we're at the historic Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown for a conversation between authors Michael Cunningham and Daniel Mendelsohn.
We are talking about books that come from books. Mm-hmm. Not that many people do that. Not, you know, write books that sort of derive from other books. And I would just love to hear you talk a little about you and books. Like, how did it start? How does it remain so central to you that you write books about books?
You know, I'm old-fashioned. I really think that literature is transformative, and I'm always trying to reenact that in whatever kind of writing I do, whether it's in the criticism that I write or the memoirs that I write, which keep alluding to these other works. I mean, for me, that it has always been the case that thinking about literature has, you know, changed my life. I mean, literature did change my life, and it is always good to think about. And, you know, whenever I do interviews and stuff like that, you know, people always say, "Oh, well, you do these two very different kinds of writing. You do these memoirs, and then you're a critic, and not just literary critic, but, you know, I write about movies, I write about opera, I do all these things." And I always say, I'm not, you know, it's not like you go to work on a Thursday and you say, "Oh, today I'm wearing my critic hat, you know, and on Monday I'm a memoirist," you know. I think everything that I write is just about the pleasure that you get from thinking about these objects, you know, these texts, and they're so interesting, and you love them. That's also why I teach. You know, we both teach, right? And I think they're great. I think they're great, and I want people to see how wonderful they are. And when I'm a critic, I want to show people how they work or sometimes don't work, you know. But it's the mechanics are so interesting. And then when I'm writing these memoirs, you know, it's interesting to think about Noah and the Ark, Because to say that, you know, to be writing, as I did in this book, an account of how members of my family perished in this little town, of whom very few people survived, to think about the story of Noah and the Ark is to, I think, to gain a kind of comfort, to realize that this story, even though this is just one instantiation of it, has been part of Western culture from the beginning. So you could say, oh, well, all literature is influenced by all other literature, and this is true. People may not know they're writing about, you know, making literature out of literature. We do it in a more, we're putting our cards on the table from the beginning sometimes. We're saying, I'm thinking about this text, The Odyssey, Virginia Woolf, whatever. But I find that comforting. You know, I guess as a nonfiction person, I never have to worry about being original, you know. So that's people say, why don't you write a novel? And I always have the same response. It's if you paid me $1 million, I couldn't make up a story. I could literally not say, like, oh, the chicken crossed the road. That would exhaust me for 2 weeks. You know?
It is exhausting.
But you know, I have no idea. It's interesting because I think, because human nature doesn't change.
Yeah. Yeah,
all literature is always true. It doesn't matter how old it is.
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who started reading great books, like mid-teens or so, not earlier than that, but I came to books at a certain point, and I love the idea that the stuff of great literature, The Odyssey, Mrs. Dalloway, you name it, is right here. And that's really important to me, the idea, just for my own purposes, that why study classical literature? Why wouldn't you? But why pay attention to the world around you and not just shut yourself off and read books? You want to do both. And it's just so important to me to be constantly mindful of the fact that everything we've read and loved is happening right now in this room.
Yeah, but that's what I always try to tell my students. You know, they don't, you know, the clothes are different, the gadgets are different, but everything else is the same.
Anybody, please. I don't even want to. I'm not sure if I want to. Questions/join. Like, let's talk. Whether it takes the form of questions or whatever anybody wants to say, I would love for us to kind of open it up to the room. Yes, please.
You gave a little clue earlier when you were talking about thinking about your mother. But how did you think about doing your writing in that context, being inspired by Virginia Woolf?
As an assigned male, how did I feel about writing so intimately about women? I can't imagine why anyone would have a problem with that, with writing across gender. It just doesn't no, there's a lot that's hard about it. Somehow trying to tap into the humanness of somebody whose physical equipment does not match mine, just like, duh. I like women. I'm not sure if every male writer does, frankly. And I do have the good sense to show, I certainly did with The Hours, with anything I write, but especially with The Hours, which is all about women, you show it to some women. Okay? Which, on one hand, leads to a kind of interesting question, like who is an authority on womanness? Am I an authority on gay white maleness? No. And yet, I also feel like I can smell a rat. So, I mean, I think when you're writing, you should write as far from your experience as you feel you can, and then, for God's sake, show it to some people whose experience more closely matches. For instance, in The Hours, there's this relationship between this Clarissa character who lives in New York today and her friend, a poet named Richard, and my brilliant friend, a poet, Marie Howe, who was one of my official readers, said, you know, not all women, but this woman would be more affectionate and open with this man. And I thought, right. Got it. You know?
Right.
like that. But just keep your fingers crossed. You know, you don't really know.
Your question reminds me of something I just read about Philip Roth, who somebody confronted him with this sort of famous issue of how women are represented in his novels and said, you know, because of the way women are represented in your novels, I have to ask, are you a misogynist? And he said, if my women are not good in my novels, it doesn't mean I'm a misogynist. It means I'm a bad writer. I thought that was a much better way to think about it. But it does raise a very interesting question, which also, if you teach, you come up about against a lot, which is this idea of appropriation, which is now a big hot-button issue for students. How can you appropriate my experience? And the flip side of that is, why should I read about people whose experiences are not me? You know, that's, you know, I can't relate to this. A kid starts a paper. He said, I can't relate to Madame Bovary. I said, who asked you to relate to her? Read the freaking book. You know? But I do think it's a very anti-literary, but, you know, I'm very suspicious of that mindset, because the point, I mean, I can't speak for novelists. I don't know how novelists work, but it's always a miracle to me. But that's the whole point, is that you can speak for somebody, and it's not hostile to do so, you know. And the flip side of that also is that, why does everything have to be about you as a reader? You know, I read Madame Bovary. I never expected to be a middle-class French housewife. You know, that was the point. Well, because I think the thing that, and this is, you know, something that a conversation needs to be about, particularly at this juncture in American history and culture, I would say, is to go back to what Michael was just saying. It's the underlying humanity of a human character which seems inviolable and consistent and eternal, whether what no matter their gender is, their sexuality, their race, their color, that this is what we respond to. Otherwise, how would anyone respond to anything that wasn't just a biography of them?
You know?
It's a big issue in colleges. It's getting harder and harder to teach literature in colleges now.
Call me old-fashioned, but I feel like one of the main points of literature,
yes,
one of the reasons there is literature, is so that we can experience the experience of being somebody who is not us.
Yeah.
That's what it's for.
Yeah.
It's you know your own story, to whatever extent you know it, but you don't need to be told your own story. You need to be told the stories, and fiction is especially, if it has a purpose.
Yeah.
It is exactly that, to not only illuminate the lives of others, but a fiction writer, because we're making this stuff up, we can penetrate as far as we can. You can go right through their viscera, through their spines, in search of what I will call their soul.
Yeah.
I may know Anna Karenina better than I know a lot of my friends.
Yeah, absolutely.
Please.
I'm curious about when you've been through that transformation, if it leads you then on a path to the next thing that you need to explore.
What leads you to from one book to the next, as it were, right? How do you make the transition? Finish that one. What do we do now?
Right.
Well, you know, if you have children in expensive private schools, it's a very practical question, actually. Desperation. No, I think always, and I think this is true whether you're a novelist or a nonfiction person, I deeply think that the seeds for every book are planted in a previous book, because you are an organic entity, so you're always interested in the same questions. And of course, you write a book because you have an itch to scratch, and once you've scratched it, you can't write the same book. But then there's some residue that you have to deal with. Like, I know I could now, as a looking at my own books as a literary critic, I could tell you exactly how one leads to the other, you know, and I didn't realize it at the time. So in this first book, I had this strand about this family history thing that was obviously on my mind, and then I finally dealt with that in the next book. And in the next book, I was thinking about journeying and family relationship. I really believe that you may not be aware of what leads you from one project to another, but I do think it's an organic progression if you can look at it coldly. I know that the book I'm working on now, in a very almost clunky, not psychologically interesting way, is coming out of the An Odyssey, because there was a part of that book that ended a strand that ended up being too big and just became a separate thing that I've sort of cut and I'm now trying to deal with now. But don't you think that, Michael, that you're always, whether consciously or not, sort of moving from one to the other?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I certainly for me, delusion plays an enormously important and central role.
Yeah.
I was saying earlier about the act of the book as you wrote it feels like a slightly inaccurate translation of the book you meant to write. The book is never quite what you had imagined, and when you look at it and it's finished, you think, well, this has good parts, but there's nothing about the Crimean War in it. There's nothing about interstellar travel. I know more as a being. I feel more and sense more and have learned more than what's in this book. And the conundrum is, of course you know that the next book is not going to be that book, that cathedral made of fire that's hovering over your head. And yet, in some kind of crazy way, you think, well, maybe the next one will be the one. But no, wait a minute. The next one will be the book of everything. I understand that it's crazy, but it's also a useful form of
craziness. Right, and the everything gets bigger as you grow older. You know, when you, like, I think typically your first book aims to do a certain thing, and then as you enlarge,
there's more everything
to try to have the book be about in a funny way. Yeah. And also you get, you know, I think with age and experience, you have more technical means at your disposal. You just know how to do certain things, you know. But I think that's why, you know, that's why you keep writing books. If you could do everything in one book, you would presumably stop writing, right? Well, no, I'm not being funny.
Yeah,
I mean,
I think.
But I think Michael is right, that there's always this sense of unfinished business. That, well, maybe I want to, and it's not necessarily about subject matter. You know, like I talked about the Crimean War and intergalactic travel, and there's nothing else to talk. It's sometimes technical things, kind of things with form you want to experiment with, things with structure, style, but the sense that there's still something else to do. Look, the only people I think who don't think this way are different, you know, like if I were, you know, what's that guy's name? Dan Brown, right? He wrote the Everything book, right? You know, and now he keeps writing the same book because it's terribly, terribly lucrative. You know, if none of your books are lucrative, you're lucky because you can keep growing. You know, because you can't just. You know.
I love that way of looking at it. Thank God for making so little money.
You never have to worry about being a franchise. You know, if you don't have any hamburgers to sell. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
For information about upcoming shows at the Hawthorne Barn, go to our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks to Brian Morris, who recorded and mixed today's program. I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.